then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 9th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. As always, we'll begin with an Edgar Steele update. It's now confirmed in the local news media in northern Idaho that the federal informant, Larry Fairfax, has made a plea bargain deal with the government to plead guilty to two counts of unlawful possession and manufacture of a firearm. Now, that's odd from the start. I thought the law differentiated between firearms and explosives, and they're sneaking him into federal court to record the plea bargain on September the 7th, so most likely by the time you folks hear this, it will be a done deal. My guess is that they'll hold off on the actual sentencing until after Edgar Steele's trial on November the 1st to keep something to hold over Fairfax's head as a threat to make sure he doesn't screw up his testimony. If Steele is acquitted because the jury simply doesn't believe Larry the Plumber, I wouldn't want to be in Fairfax's shoes facing an angry federal prosecutor and a judge when sentencing time comes. A couple of interesting things have emerged, though. First off, the feds now claim that Steele allegedly began plotting to kill his wife and his mother-in-law in November of 2009, about the same time that he suffered a massive rupture in his aorta and went into the hospital for open-heart surgery and several months of intensive care. Now, this is a different story to the one they told when Steele was first arrested, i.e. that the alleged plot began in May of this year, and Fairfax just went running to them out of sheer horror at being approached to be a hitman. Like any cop can tell you, when somebody keeps changing their story, that means that somebody's lying. Now, even more intriguing, apparently, is that there was a second federal informant in the case, one who accompanied Larry Fairfax on a road trip to Oregon, ostensibly to make sure that the bomb was still attached to the mother-in-law's car. This individual has not been named, but he or she was referred to in court documents, possibly inadvertently. Knowing how the feds work, it's probable that this was Fairfax's handler. It is of crucial importance to the Steele defense to learn exactly when and how Larry Fairfax's relationship with the FBI began. Who sicked him on Edgar Steele, and for what purpose, and what was the role of this as yet unidentified second individual? I wonder if Steele's court-appointed attorney will pick up on any of this. Moving along, our regular listeners will be aware of the fact that for some time now I've been asking you guys that rather than email your questions and comments to me and have me read them out on the air, you should make your own audio files for me to play on here so that there's some voices on here other than my own, at least until such time as I can get a partner for the show or master the technology to do call-ins. Well, this week some people have finally started taking me at my word. One of the things I suggested that you talk about was your own personal awakening to racial consciousness, how you first became aware that the world is not as advertised, how you first discovered the Northwest Migration, how you were first introduced to the Jewish question, so forth and so on. Now, this is Mike from Pennsylvania who took me up on that one.
Hello, comrades. My name is Mike. I'm 21 years old, and I guess you can say, in the grand scheme of things, I'm relatively new to the movement. I started getting involved in these kind of things about 3 years ago. One of the things that originally got me to consider a white nationalist ideology was when I was raised in a Catholic school and I began questioning everything that was told to me in the school. This was from teen angst at first, but I questioned not only the religious, but also the social ideas that they would teach in their curriculum. I realized that such social ideas were not only taught at the school I was at, but at all educational institutions throughout the country nowadays. However, when I was feeling the angst and urge for rebellion, it was the religious teachings that I turned away from the most. But remember, this was Judeo-Christianity they were teaching, and not the pro-white Christian ideologies that our movement has. One of the ideas that they really harped on a lot in my school was this: everyone equal, multiracial, multicultural phenomenon. Now, remember, this was a Catholic school, so politically speaking, there were many people who were so-called conservatives in this environment, such as faculty, but they were neocons. They were these American neocon conservative types, and we all know what the problem is with that. Although they usually understand economic problems pretty well, they want to keep their gun rights, but when it comes to anything racial, they don't even touch those matters. Any dissent toward mainstream racial ideas was only vaguely hinted at, if even that. So as part of my rebellion against Judeo-Christianity, I looked into Odinism, which I first gained exposure to through European heavy metal bands, incidentally enough. I became fascinated by it and researched the Norse myths and heathen ideology and read various books on the subject. I came to realize that there's a deeper purpose to reviving this ancient culture. I think one reason many people do decide to do that is because there is no culture in modern-day America. It doesn't give you anything. It offers you absolutely nothing except for fancy little toys and lackluster television shows. Well, looking into Germanic mythology, I was able to find something. Something that came from our people, from my own people. So as I looked into ancient white heritage, there were many books that were influential, but the most influential person on me individually was the man who coined the 14 words, David Lane himself. He was the one who created the phrase, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children." Now, I know religion is a very touchy and controversial subject in the movement, but I will say for myself that I am willing to put theological disagreements aside and place the benefit of our people above all other considerations. I do believe that Odinism is good for our folk because it gives them a sense of culture and higher ideal that mainstream society severely lacks. And if Christian identity is what works for some people, then that's their own decision and they have a right to their beliefs just as I have a right to mine. It's an individual choice. The point is, these belief systems give us something of our own, something for our people, and that is something that you can't find anywhere else in our society and in our world today. Now, folks, I'm currently a college student, and I'll be the first to tell you, college sucks. It really sucks for anyone that thinks the way we do. But at the time being, it may still be a good idea to use what we have at our disposal to our advantage. Yes, they're going to try to push their universalist, multicultural, and a lot of times straight-up anti-white message on you, and a lot of them don't even try to hide it at all. However, one way to combat this is to formulate a plan to make it to the Northwest homeland. That's what I'm doing now, and so far, knock on wood, it's coming along fairly well. Start saving up your money. I know this is easy for me to say than it would be for some people because I'm young and I do not have the obligations that would burden me the way some people may. I don't have a family to feed or take care of, so I have kind of an advantage in that regard. But while I'm in school, I have a part-time job, so I can save some money. There are a few recommendations I'll make in regard to doing this. For one thing, stop purchasing anything that you don't need. DVDs, CDs, iPods, iPhones, gadgets, all these things. Anything that you don't actually need, don't buy. It's going to be a bit difficult at first because this society throws all this stuff at you left and right and tries to convince you that you will never be satisfied without it. It will definitely be a challenge to resist that, but once you do start doing that, it gets a lot easier and you'll be surprised how much money you can save up just by cutting out things that you don't absolutely need. Another recommendation that I can give might seem obvious at first, but it will be beneficial if you make an attempt to do it, is shop cheap. Now, I know that eating healthy and organic foods is important and maintaining health is important. I'm not suggesting that you live off Mickey D's every day, but sometimes you have to make a decision between what's more expensive and what's less expensive, and a lot of these advertisements for so-called healthy foods are very deceptive. With many of these foods, they just jack up the price and it's really no different or very slightly different than the ordinary product. So please use discretion. Don't let your health go down the toilet, but do try to make the most practical decision possible. Also, set yourself a time frame. It's understandable that you cannot just pack up all your belongings and shoot across the country from wherever you are, but you can make a tentative plan as to how you can get to the homeland, and I say tentative here to adapt to setbacks here and there, but that doesn't mean just keep pushing it off. Give yourself a timetable, set yourself goals, and then follow through with it. And folks, one last thing I'd like to say is that having a goal really makes situations much easier. It doesn't matter if you're stuck in some interracial zoo of a job or hearing the incessant squawking of one of the so-called chosen ones all day, or sitting in a university classroom while some snide, pompous professor tries to shove multi-culti crap down your throat. Having a goal really helps and makes it at least a bit easier to deal with these things, because it gives you something to work for. It gives you a higher ideal, whatever ideology accompanies that higher ideal of getting to the homeland to found a white nation. And I really do believe that there should be some kind of spiritual aspect to all this, whether it's Odinism or Christian identity or national socialism or whatever. It all goes back to nature and abiding by the laws of nature. Procreation of one's own kind is the highest instinct in all living creatures, and that's the best thing that anyone can strive for. And anyone, regardless of what their beliefs are, who is legitimately trying to cure the existence of our people and a future for white children definitely has my respect. So that's a little bit about me and some advice from me. I hope it's helpful to you, and I wish you all the best of luck. I hope to meet some of you someday. Take care, comrades.
Another suggestion I made for your own audio files was that some of you explain to our listeners your views on the subject of communism, your understanding of what communism is. Now, this can be important in view of the fact that the Obama regime is now making the first ever serious effort to transform the United States into, if not exactly a Soviet dictatorship, then a country run on the principles of Marxism as opposed to free enterprise. Let's just say that Obongo and his Jew crew are trying to transform the United States into a non-capitalist country, which is a pretty significant change for the heart of world capitalism. I didn't get any American responses to this, but I did get this brief and rather theoretical audio from John in the UK.
In order to understand communism, I think it would be helpful to look at the caste system of traditional Indo-European society. At the top of said society, you would have the priestly or intellectual caste. Beneath them in the hierarchy would be the warrior caste, followed by merchants and finally serfs. There are also those who are outside the system of classification. We would know them today as bums, dropouts, drifters, you know, the kind who swell the ranks of leftist groups. Marxist-Leninism is an attempt to upturn this order and have what is called the dictatorship of the proletariat. This would be a period of extreme brutality run by a tyrannical, centralized government, the purpose of which is to destroy the class enemy, that being the church, nobles, soldiers loyal to the old order, and so on. Of course, the lower castes simply cannot rule themselves, so this is where those who agitated and organized the masses to destroy their own culture step in as the new masters. One only need look at the history of Russia to find out who these agitators who become the new masters are.
I noticed that in his recording, John doesn't dare say the word Jew out loud, which I suppose is understandable, since any criticism or disrespectful expression of opinion about the Jews or Israel now carries a sentence of 7 years in prison in Great Britain. Americans bitch and moan about all the restrictions that the regime here is constantly trying to impose on our First Amendment rights, and with justification. But I don't think we really appreciate just how bad things are for white nationalists elsewhere in the world. In England especially, there are spy cameras on every street corner allowing the police to watch everyone's every move, and to so much as utter a word of criticism along any racial line is a criminal offense. Indeed, it's quite conceivable that for a European, especially an Englishman or a German, even to listen to this Radio Free Northwest podcast is some kind of criminal offense, especially if he actually downloads it. Now, I mention this because one of our European comrades also sent in an MP3 file on the Jews this week, and judging from what I could tell of his accent, I think he might have been a German, in which case I can really understand why he wanted to take precautions. But he used some kind of voice distortion software that made him sound like Ming the Merciless broadcasting to the Earthlings from the planet Zargon. Now, comrade, whoever you are, I'm sorry, I'm going to need you to send in your submission in a little bit more understandable format. Remember, you're talking mostly to Homer Simpson here, and Homer doesn't handle subtlety or complexity well. Finally, Gretchen the librarian sent in a comment on the proposed project to create a kind of white Bilderberg group specializing in scholarships and career tracking for young whites into the teaching profession and also into politics.
Good evening, comrades. I'd like to talk about this scholarship idea. The first and most essential thing is that in the United States, we're under a system of checks and balances. Essentially, that means that no faction or individual ever becomes that powerful to the point of changing the whole system, which is essentially what you would have to do because the whole premise of the system would have to be different. I mean, you'd have to be basing the system on a racial premise instead of a sort of a universal premise. The thing about the scholarship itself, even if you could assure that the person understands the meaning of the scholarship and is always acting as always indentured to the scholarship, even years after they leave school, is the fact that this influence, even if you could make this person into a robot, the influence is always going to be diluted by other people that they're going to have to work with and the constituents they're going to have to work with, even if they do go into politics. Now, as far as this group of disgruntled businessmen, okay, there may be some disgruntled businessmen out there, but the thing is, if in fact these businessmen are so disgruntled and willing to help and they've got so much money, then where were they when Pat Buchanan or David Duke were trying to run for president? I mean, if there was ever a time for these businessmen to step in and help, I suppose that would have been the time. And if they couldn't or wouldn't do it then, I don't have much hope for this notion. So I think in general, for any plan, you're going to have to make a ton of assumptions, such as with this plan, you're assuming, okay, they get the scholarship, and even after they're out of school, they're still adhering to that. I mean, unless you have some mechanism to make sure they do that, I'm not even quite sure how this would work under any circumstances. But at any rate, thank you for the idea. It's interesting to learn about these ideas, to think about them. So if you have any other, you or anyone else have any other ideas, I don't want to discourage that. So, all right. Thank you for listening.
Right. I think we've come to the first music break. We've had some odd languages on here, including Irish, Welsh, Russian, and Vulgar German. Now, time for some Latin, I think. This is a medieval liturgical song, a madrigal, I think, sung by an old folk group that some of you old-timers like me may remember called Steel Eye Span.
Gaudete, gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete,
tempus adest gratiae, o quod optabamus, carmine latitiae,
Gaudete, gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete.
Deus homo factus est, natura mirante, undus renovatus est,
Gaudete, gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete.
Ego nostro contius, salediam in nostro, benedicat Domino, salus regi nostro.
Gaudete, gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine, gaudete.
Okay, on to the emails. Here's one from a guy named Bruce Hain in the UK. A long one, but the crux of it is, why do I say nigger? Again, another question we get almost every week in one form or another, but which I'm sure Bruce sincerely believes he's the first to ask. Like a lot of topics, I've been over this before, but there are now 32 previous Radio Free Northwests, and I understand that people don't have time to download them all and listen to them. I think maybe I might do a kind of FAQ broadcast, maybe next week, in which I go over all of the standard questions and issues, and when people ask these repetitive questions, I'll simply refer them to RFN number 34 on such and such a date, something like that. Anyway, let's have a quick reprise here on the nigger thing. The main reason I use words like nigger and kike and beaner and faggot is that the Jewish and liberal ruling elite does not
want me to. And whatever the regime wants white people not to do, we are under a moral obligation to do as often as possible. Now, this isn't quite as simplistic an answer as it sounds. There is good, hard reasoning behind this. If any of you out there have not read George Orwell's historic novel 1984, I recommend in the strongest possible terms that you obtain a copy and do so immediately. Even though it was written in 1948, it's timeless. It explains just so very much about the world we live in today. When you get your copy, I recommend that you start with the appendix at the end of the book, which discusses something called Newspeak. It's an essay on the use and perversion of language in order to control thought, and it's even more applicable today than it was 60 years ago when it was first written. Long story short, it's not racial insensitivity or hurting the poor little monkoid's feelings or anything like that, which is the regime's concern. What the liberals want to do is to control our very thoughts by making us so afraid to speak certain words out loud for fear of economic retaliation and, in Europe, legal punishment, or in this country, afraid of psychopathic black violence, that we censor our own selves so effectively that we don't even think such words or think about the concepts and ideas of racial difference and white superiority that those words convey. The power elite in Western society doesn't only want us afraid to say nigger. They don't even want us to think nigger or to be able to think it. The wealthy liberals and the Jews who rule us don't want white people to think any thought that contradicts what we're taught in our politically correct classrooms or our left-wing Zionist state media. The regime does not want white people to have in their minds words which can even so much as formulate forbidden thoughts, never mind express them. The long-term goal, as stated in Orwell's 1984, is to make so-called thought crime impossible because we'll lack even the language necessary to formulate forbidden thoughts in our minds. It is absolutely essential that white people break through this thought control process and recover true freedom of speech and thought. And that, first and foremost, represents the freedom to say nigger and kike and faggot. Because, you see, the liberals who rule us are not just vicious and evil, they're wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. There is no such thing as an African-American. There is no such thing as a black person. The term person implies an equality with white people which does not, in fact, exist in the real world. They are not people, at least not in the same sense that we are. They're niggers, and they know it even if we don't. Why do you think they call themselves nigger all the time? They don't respect themselves, so why should we respect them? And then again, we don't respect ourselves, since we won't fight for what we have and we let them spit and piss all over us, so why the hell should anybody respect us? There is no such thing as a gay person. There is nothing gay about filthy and unsanitary perversions that spread loathsome diseases. The word homosexual is simply a descriptive term for certain unnatural sexual acts. It does not describe the people who commit those acts. Those people are faggots, queers, bugger boys, dykes, and other terms I won't use but which are more colorful and descriptive. To refer to these people as gay or homosexual, or without any pejorative wording at all, is to imply that they and their perversions are somehow acceptable in civilized society, and they're not. You see what I'm getting at, Bruce? White people and the defenders of Western civilization have to stop letting the enemy define the parameters of discussion and determine what is and is not acceptable by way of thought and language. We need to force that power out of their hands and back into ours, preferably with a good sharp blow to the head. That's another thing. We need to be free to at least think in those terms, to encompass in our imaginations the concept of liberals and Jews being forced to do things, being compelled to change their behavior, and being punished for what they've done in the past. And I don't mean by being scolded on blogs. The thought is father to the deed, as liberals know full well. If we are free to think disrespectfully of minorities and perverts and the system itself, then it's only a matter of time before we start thinking about other things. And that's what they're really terrified of. There is nothing that frightens a Jew or a liberal more than a white man whose mind is not under their control. Okay, next email. Another variation on a previously discussed theme, but the same consideration applies since I know all of you haven't been able to take 32 hours off and listen to the entire Radio Free Northwest series thus far. I really do need to put together that FAQ broadcast. Anyway, this is from somebody who doesn't want me to use his name because he's active duty military. Greetings, HAC. On one of your more recent programs, you invited the listening audience to throw the proverbial hat into the ring with ideas on how to take the Northwest migration to a higher level of practiced reality. One of your listeners suggested a clandestine ninja society of zillionaires fronting big bucks to create white teachers and politicians and take over the Republican Party, etc. Interesting, of course, but naive. As we all know, that extreme amount of wealth, 99% of the time, leads you down the path of liberal idealism, or at the very least, moderate liberalism. So the concept of getting a whole band of Daddy Warbucks is a bit hard to choose, but I digress. Back to a spark of thought that was inspired by a question of the listening audience and a post on a white social site. It was an article about islands that are openly for sale. Most inspiring was the thought of a larger, functioning, and developed island, water, gas, housing, electric resources, etc. in the BC coastal area of the Northwest. Now, keep in mind, this would only be the springboard for the eventual larger Northwest American Republic, the point being that the very practice of the Northwest Republic could begin sooner rather than later. An island would also make security very easy and keep unwanted eyes or informants at a distance without them wasting endless resources. This would also, if successful, be a beacon on the hilltop for our beloved Northwest Republic, proving it to be valid and no longer just our far-fetched, angry white male Christmas wish list. Love to hear your thoughts, pro and con on such a hypothetical theory. Okay, quick reprise. This might sound like a variation on the run away to the North Woods and hide. Well, I don't want to use the word heresy because this isn't a religion, and I don't want to use the word error because that sounds arrogant and patronizing on my part. Most of the people who advocate these things are perfectly sincere, and like I've said, they honestly believe that they're the first people to whom this has ever occurred, and the first people who have ever asked a certain question or brought up a certain issue. And I really hate to sound like I'm running them down or denigrating them. I'm not. Okay, let's call these ideas either distractions or sidetracks, okay? Now, this island thing sounds like a variation on the runaway and hide in the North Woods sidetrack, but it's not. It's a variation on the compound distraction. Now, this is an outmoded tactic from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. A group purchases a few acres of cheap land somewhere way out in the boondocks, usually with somebody's life savings, or in Dr. Pierce's case, with $300,000 in order armored car loot, and then they create their own little mini empire there on the 20 or 30 or maybe a couple of hundred acres of scrubland. As I've mentioned before, back in the early 70s, when I first got involved, everybody and his kid brother had a headquarters building or a compound, or at least a farm out in the woods, someplace where we could get together. And they were nice. They were like a little bit of liberated territory. People would drive all across the country from coast to coast just to spend a few days or even a few hours there. When you stepped onto the property, you could feel a great weight just lifting off your shoulders. Well, that's not the case anymore. The compounds and the buildings are pretty much all gone, either foreclosed or seized in malicious and abusive lawsuits, or in some cases burned to the ground by the government, sometimes with bloodshed involved, notably at Waco. But the idea still lives on. Anytime our kind of group is referred to on TV or in the movies, we always seem to have a compound and uniforms and all kinds of illegal automatic weapons and explosives. Would it were true. So, now we have the compound idea surfacing again, only this time it's an island. Okay, fine, let's look at this. Now, first off, we need to find a suitable island someplace in the Straits of Juan de Fuca. It will have to be on the American side so that the First and Second Amendments would apply and Canadian hate laws would not, so that lets British Columbia out. Alaska's out as well due to considerations of weather and also because Alaska is technically not part of the homeland yet. It may be someday and it may not. We don't know how that'll play out. I know that there are people who want to extend the so-called Northwest homeland as far south as San Francisco and as far southeast as Salt Lake City and as far straight east as North Dakota, basically so they themselves won't have to pack a moving van and go to all the inconvenience of migrating. It's essentially just another excuse for white laziness, but that's another topic. Okay, so we find our little island someplace, like I said, probably in the far Puget Sound, somewhere up off Port Townsend or Anacortes, wherever. Then we have to come up with a very large sum of money to buy or at least to lease the island, possibly from the very government we're trying to remove from power. Now, that's where those zillionaire ninjas and Daddy Warbucks our friend refers to would come in real handy. Now, let's assume that we can put together some kind of consortium willing to plunk down $1 million or whatever would be needed to buy a small island. Now, this begs the question, if that kind of financing ever became available, are there really not better things that we could be doing with the money rather than buying real estate? Real estate ties us down like an anchor. Land can't be picked up and packed in a station wagon and moved when the lawyers come crawling out of the ooze. Land is subject to confiscation through baseless and malicious lawsuits from people like Morris Dees and Willard. Would heavy money like that really not be better used, put into propaganda and media designed to break out of the movement bubble and spread our message to the people and get us a pipeline directly into the white community? Frankly, If anyone ever approached me and wanted to put down that kind of money, I would buy some kind of radio station or internet radio hub, or I'm not quite sure what, but it would be something to do with media, and I would also invest quite a bit of that money into a tabloid newspaper. Anyway, let's get on with the island idea. Let's assume that we go whole hog with the plan, and after years of planning and hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars of expenditure later, we have our little island with buildings and septic tanks and generators and everything we need on it. Now let's further assume that we can actually get a significant number of people to relocate there, and that might not be as hard as we think. As hard a time as we're having getting white people to get up off their asses and move anywhere, it isn't impossible. Now, I've noticed that as we try to build our own areas of settlement here in the Northwest homeland, that once a certain tipping point is reached and a community gets as few as half a dozen white families living in a designated area, then all of a sudden the volunteers, small v, start stepping forward and packing the moving vans. You give white Americans even the small beginnings of a crowd to hide in and they'll come running to join it. It's being real lone wolves, being true pioneers and going first that we have trouble with, because the alpha gene has been bred out and socially engineered out of us by the Jews and the media. Like I said, we can still take initiative and we can still be brave, but we have to have a permission slip from the kikes. Anyway, the main problem with the whole compound idea is something that the naysayers try to use against the whole Northwest migration. Now, you may have heard or read of some of these naysaying goat dancing types screaming and gibbering about how we can't concentrate all our people in one area because it'll make it easy for Zog to destroy us all in one fell swoop. Okay, this is basically just another excuse to do nothing, and we know how good white men are at doing that. We can't do much of anything else, but hot damn, we are great at figuring out logical, reasonable, complex reasons to do nothing. However, there is a slight bit of truth in this one naysay, in that it's not a good idea for us to concentrate all our eggs in one very small basket within the homeland itself, like a compound of 20 or 30 acres, or on an island someplace. The Northwest is huge. People who haven't been here don't realize just how big it is, and we have plenty of room to maneuver up here. But if we concentrate ourselves in some little farm or compound or just a few acres, that really does give the enemy something to concentrate their surveillance and their dirty tricks on. We don't need to be making it easy on these people. I know they're spying on us and intercepting our email and our phone calls, but why make it easy for them to identify people who are associated with us, to take down license plate numbers, get pictures through telephoto lenses to update their files, plant electronic eavesdropping devices in offices and buildings we have, so forth and so on? We need to make these bastards from all these secret police agencies work for their monthly direct deposit slip. If we concentrate everything in a building or a compound or on an island someplace, we lose mobility and we give the enemy a stationary target. This leads to all kinds of problems. A good example is that malicious and abusive lawsuit wherein Morris Dees was able to steal Pastor Butler's home from him up in Hayden Lake. I know it's considered bad form to say anything that might be interpreted as even remotely critical about the old Aryan Nation days, because everybody's got such good memories of those annual congresses up on our own land there at Hayden Lake. But we have to be honest about this, folks, like we need to start being honest about the rest of our movement's past. Those big, huge gatherings generated a lot of problems because all kinds of bad elements and dodgy people slipped in. And that was because that 20-acre compound was a movement magnet. It drew ATF agents. It drew FBI spies. It drew undercover cops of every description. It drew undercover reporters. And above all, it drew a seemingly endless supply of weird, dysfunctional white people who cause nothing but trouble. Now, we don't need to be creating movement magnets on an island or anywhere else, because what they attract is more often than not undesirable. Let's put it like that. Second music break. One Aryan people whom we've not had represented so far in our program is the Afrikaners. Now, this is kind of understandable because the fact is that although the Afrikaans people have a lot of strong points, being musical isn't one of them. I don't know why. For one thing, of all the European peoples, the Dutch themselves are probably the least musically inclined, and again, I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe life on those farms out in the Bushveld down through the centuries was just so rough that there was never much time for music. Now, don't get me wrong, there is a body of Afrikaner folk music, but it consists mostly of fairly simple ditties with lone guitar and fiddle accompaniment. I don't ever recall even hearing of an Afrikaner folk group as such, not even when I lived there, although I'm sure that's just an oversight on my part, and I'm sure some of our listeners can point me to such a group in their music somewhere on the internet. Please do. The most well-known Afrikaner folk song is one about a good-looking Boer girl up in the Transvaal called Sari Moray, but I was not able to find an actual Afrikaans vocalist singing this anywhere on the net, although again, I'm sure that was just my poor search engine technique and there must be one out there somewhere. One of the best versions of Sari Moray I ever heard was sung by the Scots folk singer Kenneth McKellar, who once recorded a whole album of Afrikaans songs. I had that album in Rhodesia and I've been searching for it desperately all across the net. Unfortunately, I can't remember the title of it. Anyway, this is the military march version of Sari Moray, which is the best one I could find. This is the Band of the Royal Dragoon Guards. Quick email question from Henry in Colorado. Dear HAC, since we now have Mexican drug cartels taking over parts of Arizona and the federal government isn't doing anything about it or allowing the local police to do anything about it, why couldn't white people take over parts of the Northwest homeland in a similar manner, or for that matter, any other part of America? Well, Henry, the answer is simple. We could if we wanted to. The difference is that the Mexicans are not afraid. We are. When that changes, and when white people are no longer afraid that the big bad policeman might hurt us, then we as well can do whatever we want to do in order to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. That's all that has to happen. White people have to stop being afraid. Now a quick internal NF note here. Over the past week, we had some internet activity from some people, including one man who runs his own website and does his own podcasts similar to this one. And this gentleman was nice enough to say some kind things about myself on the Northwest Front. I duly gave these people some publicity, and I got some, not exactly complaints, but let's say comments from some of our other comrades who, for one reason or another, seemed to feel that these individuals' efforts weren't as lenientroy as they might have been, lenientroy being a German word that means true to the party line. I won't get into details because one always has to be careful about setting off episodes of goat dancing and space madness on the internet that gets everybody whirling like a dervish Dervish. Guys, just about every week, I'm on here calling for you people out there in my audience to show individual initiative in serving and advancing the 14 words in the Northwest American Republic. I can't very well complain when you do as I ask. I deeply appreciate the contributions of both of these comrades, the gentleman with the website and podcast, and the female comrade on Craigslist. Her language was colorful and to the point, true, but guys, we're going to get a lot of this as more and more people become interested in the Northwest Imperative. It's impossible to micromanage a revolution or even micromanage a small political group if you want to be for real and not turn into some kind of weird sect or personality cult, and that can't be allowed to happen with the Northwest Front. The situation is simply too serious. We can't afford to mess around anymore with paranoid, fearless leaders who are so afraid that their own people are talking behind their back or conspiring against them that they demand the members of the group, all two dozen of them usually, march in some kind of lockstep, which is usually what motivates all the micromanagement. We do have a manual in the Northwest Front, true. It's called the White Book, and it's available only by mail. I don't want it on the internet, and so far as I know, thus far everyone has respected my wishes on that. It does detail in a general way the kind of activism we want our NF people to engage in, but it's not a Bible, it's not a step-by-step set of directions like stereo instructions, and it's not set in stone. I say again, people, the Northwest migration is an idea for all white people, just like the 14 words. Different people are going to have different visions and interpretations of that idea. Not all of these visions will match my own, as expressed in the Northwest Independence novels. Indeed, that's one reason I'm a bit hesitant to embark on novel number 5, because it will deal with the future of the Republic, and my vision of not only how political and economic issues might develop and how different problems might be faced and solved, but my whole concept of what a white homeland and what the NAR should be. Now, that might well get me in trouble to the point where it affects NF operations if enough white people decide they're being asked to fight and die for some idealized fictional society in a book they might not agree with. I've given a few glimpses of some of my personal views in the Northwest Constitution and the Hill of the Ravens, and so far people have concentrated on the fantasy revenge violence and genetically engineered dogs and the silly scene with the ducks, and they haven't paid much attention to some of my more novel ideas, no pun intended, like legalized dueling and arranged marriages in the National Labor Service. I have solid reasons for advocating all those institutions, but not everyone might agree with that reasoning, and they might not get that it's a work of fiction, not some kind of holy writ. I'm not sure it's a good idea for me to appear to be trying to impose my own vision over everybody else's. We do have a draft constitution that we put together in 2006 as a kind of a patch to slap over the hole when all of a sudden everything collapses and it all falls into our laps, as may well happen given the sheer level of incompetence now manifesting itself in the ruling class. But before the Northwest Republic can be properly constituted, there's going to have to be a constitutional convention, and all of this stuff is going to have to be gone over again and ratified, and any changes that the real people want for the real republic will have to be adopted by that convention. I just hope we can come to some kind of arrangement without cutting each other's throats over things like religion. My guess is that if such a convention took place today, we'd probably end up with some kind of highly libertarian, almost proto-anarchist Tea Party type society with barely enough government to maintain a functioning military, which would be pretty much the minimum standard, and which was more or less what the original founders set up in 1789. That's no secret that I would prefer a little more centralization than that, with a heavy infusion of National Socialism, which I think we're going to need to survive. But let's be honest, if I'm still around at the time, it's not really going to be up to me, nor should it be. We can't impose some form of government on the people of the homeland that they don't want. Remember, that's what's been happening for the past 100 years, and what has specifically been happening under Obama in the past 18 months or so. Just as I can't run a political movement without help, neither I nor anyone else will be able to impose a new state without consent, and that's going to mean participation from everybody with an idea or a dream of white freedom. And this is why I encourage individual initiative and participation of all kinds, and why we mustn't get upset if all of that participation doesn't conform to something in the brigade or some of our own preconceived ideas. We need to get into practice for the time when Obama and his filthy gun thugs are gone, and we really do have to sit down and build our own brave new world. I'm not saying, by the way, that there won't be novel number 5. I've also had some people contact me, and they are very interested in it, and they really want to help me get on with it, so forth and so on. And, you know, vox populi, vox dei. If there's a market for it, somebody's going to fill it. So I'm just saying that this is not something that I need to go charging into, because we've reached a point where something like that is going to have an effect on the course of events in the real world, and we need to consider that course. Okay, third music break. We've had bagpipes before on here, both the Scottish war pipe and the Irish Uilleann pipes. But it's not generally known outside British folk music circles that there is in fact an English version of the pipes called Northumbrian pipes, although they're mostly used by Scottish musicians, as in this case. They're similar to the Irish Uilleann pipes in that they're played under the arm while seated and inflated with a bellows. Now, the sound is very distinctive, almost like a Scottish bagpipes practice chanter, if anyone knows what that sounds like. Now, this is the Corries.
Bothwell Castle, ages gone, have left thee mouldering and all alone, while noble Douglas still retains thy verdant groves and fair domains. No Saxon foe may storm thy walls, or riot in thy regal halls. Long, long has slept brave Wallace shade, and broken now his battle blade.
I'd like to ask you folks out there to help me out on something, help me understand something. There's a phenomenon among us that threatens our very existence, something in our psychological makeup, something that I, honest to God, just don't get, and I need to. We white nationalists come in many different versions: National Socialist, Odinist, Christian Identity, Ordinary Christian Fundamentalists, Militia, Sovereign Citizen types, you know all the variations, I'm sure. But one factor that we all share is that we are part of a tiny persecuted minority, and I'm dead serious about that. Anyone who doubts that racially conscious white people are persecuted should try making a few derogatory comments about blacks or Jews in public, especially in his workplace, and see how fast the hammer comes down. We can be legally fired from our jobs, denied employment, denied college admission, or expelled from university. We can be denied housing or evicted from our homes. We can have our children torn away from us by the law and given to lefty scum to be raised as liberals and perverts. We can be arrested and sent to prison for something we post on the internet that some federal official doesn't like. And we can even be murdered like Jeff Hughes without anything at all being done about it. Down through the years, I've seen every one of these things happen to people I know. Only we are subject to so-called hate crime laws. We are indeed the last minority in the Western world who are persecuted and denied the equal protection of the law as a matter of intentional legal and political policy. In Europe, we are persecuted and imprisoned by statute law for our very thoughts, for the crime of existing. Like I said, we are a persecuted minority. Now, every other persecuted minority in history has survived its times of persecution by huddling together and finding strength and safety in numbers, by living together in communities, sometimes fortified communities like the medieval Jewish ghettos, which, by the by, were places where the Jews voluntarily settled and confined themselves, very seldom neighborhoods where they were forced by local law to live. We saw this in the early years of this country's existence when immigrant groups clustered together in the same neighborhoods in New York and Boston and Chicago and everywhere. Irish, Polish, Jewish, German and Scandinavian, and Chinese neighborhoods. Today, there are massive Iranian communities in Atlanta, Iraqis in El Cajon, California, and Detroit, Armenians in Fresno, Palestinians in Detroit and New Jersey, Israelis in Los Angeles, and don't let's even get into modern-day New York, where dozens of nationalities, from Dominicans to Bangladeshis and Russian Jews to Somalis and Hondurans and Georgians, each have their own turf. Every other persecuted or even unpersecuted minority in history has banded together to resist the superior power and numbers of the majority and its government, and to preserve their own identity. So, riddle me this. Why don't we? For almost 10 years now, I've been advocating the independence of a sovereign homeland for white people in the Pacific Northwest, and I've been pleading for racially conscious white people to come home physically to the Northwest homeland. But not just that. I ask them to come to specific communities and live and make their lives within half an hour's drive of one another, so that there will be some kind of safety net and some kind of support system for our people in every sense of the word. Indeed, I view one of the primary tasks of the Northwest Front as being the creation of such primary settlement areas where we can have first 3 or 4, then half a dozen, and then a dozen, and then 20, 30 or more racially aware white families and individuals living within half an hour's drive from each other, where we can be all for one and one for all. Which is how persecuted minorities continue to exist despite the efforts of the ruling powers to eradicate them. Imagine a whole neighborhood full of our people, a small suburb or town off I-5 where we could elect mayors and aldermen. Yeah, I know I've expressed skepticism about that kind of thing in the past as a be-all and end-all because in the first place it's just not possible to build a real Beaver Cleaverville, and in the second place it's going to take a lot more than that to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. But as part of an overall independent strategy building up to revolution, there's no reason on earth why white nationalist neighborhoods at least shouldn't be feasible. Mexicans and Somalis and Ukrainians do it all the time. I just don't understand why we can't or won't. There are enough of us out there now to change the demographics of 3.5 northwestern states if we can just get your asses here. And then once word gets out that there's a crowd here for them to hide in, millions more whites would follow. Remember what I said earlier about a very low tipping point for such projects. Yeah, it could be done. Having all of our people move into communities, half an hour's drive from one another, so that we won't be alone and isolated anymore, makes absolute and total sense. So much so that I'm by no means the first person to propose such a thing. But no one has ever been able to make it fly until now, when we in the Northwest Front are finally beginning to see a few tiny buds of success, but it's still going as slow as molasses in wintertime. This should have been done decades ago. Why hasn't it been? What the hell is wrong with us? Everyone tells me how they love my Northwest novels, but those are fiction. In the real world, it's like pulling teeth to get people up here, even for a scouting trip. Why, for God's sake? I've heard all the excuses until my ears are blue in the face, if you'll pardon the mixed metaphor. Oh, Harold, I'm so broke. I just can't save enough money. My car's all clapped out, and I need a new transmission. I gotta finish this one course, or else so many years of college. But of course, since you don't have any colleges or technical schools at all in the Northwest, I can't possibly go to school there. I'm stuck taking care of the old folks. I'm scared I can't sell my house for what I put into it. I'm scared I can't get a job up there. I'm scared the FBI will find out and I'll get in trouble. Yada, 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 and on and on and on. Jesus Christ on a raft. God, I am sick of offering you people the one way in which we can possibly save our whole species and civilization from literal physical extinction, as in ceasing to exist at all, and being told in more or less a whine all the reasons why it can't be done, or at least why you can't possibly do it. For a long time, I thought it was my fault that somehow I just wasn't finding the right approach or the right words in order to convey to you some sense of urgency about all this. But as the years go by and my words keep going in one ear and out the other, I'm really starting to wonder if there might not be some kind of deep psychological weakness or syndrome in modern white people, other than the several mental and emotional handicaps we already know we have, of course. I mean over and above laziness and cowardice and the American sense of entitlement that refuses to come home until we can get a guarantee that we'll be given things for free. I'm not kidding. Apparently freedom itself isn't enough. We have to give out free goodies as well, like we were used car salesmen. But, you know, I really am starting to think that maybe even if we could offer guaranteed employment and moving services and cheap housing with no risk, that still wouldn't be enough for some of you to come home. No, there's something else, some other reason behind our apparently deranged refusal to carry out such a simple, basic and perfectly feasible plan to secure our futures and improve our lives. And whatever it is, it's something very bad and ugly. Well, that's us. 21st century white boys are carrying around a lot of bad and ugly baggage. I'd really like to know what this thing is. It's got to be some kind of really deep, really bizarre death wish. Because our deliberate avoidance of one another, our refusal to come together and live in communities out of sheer survival, just doesn't make sense. Okay, I tell you what, I'm going to stop here because while I have some theories about what's going on, I have sense enough to realize that for me to articulate them would not be, helpful, shall we say. What I will tell you guys is this. This Northwest migration thing is something that has to happen. It is a matter of overwhelming historical urgency, and it trumps and overrides all other considerations. I'm not really concerned with your money problems. I'm not concerned with your paranoid fears. I don't give a damn about whatever weird crap is going on in your minds. I need you to answer the call of history and step up to the plate. I need you to come home now. And while you're dawdling out there, I need you to at least bust your butt getting the northwestfront.org internet address before as many white people as possible. 2 weeks ago, we actually broke 3,000 unique visitors in 1 week, with almost 6,000 page loads, if memory serves. That's the best we've ever done, but as internet websites go, that's crap. That's nothing. Last week, we fell down again. We barely broke 2,600. You know all those characters in my Northwest novels that you love so much, like Zach Hatfield and Cody Brock and Nightshade and Shane and Rooney and Oscar and so on? Well, they're not just fiction. They're out there in real life or in real life equivalents, but they're not here, and they're not working with the Northwest Front yet. Why? Because they don't know we're here yet. Guys, we can put up the best website in the world, and I can do a podcast that puts Rush Limbaugh in the shade 5 times a week if I want, and none of it will make a damn bit of difference if no one sees the website and no one hears my voice. If I can't persuade you to start packing the moving van and come home, then for Christ's sake, at least start posting northwestfront.org and all the URLs for Radio Free Northwest broadcasts anywhere and everywhere a white man, woman, or child might see it. I can't not do this without you. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.